Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 1st of October 2017. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London and Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Cover. I'm going to talk about Le Grand Moor at the Trafalgar Studios. It's in their smaller space. This is a play by Stephen Clarke from the early 2010s. It was specifically written for the star Julian Clary, who appears in this with James Nelson Joyce as a dinner guest who Julian Clary's, well, we're not entirely sure if he is an architect, but he probably is, has invited back, having been sort of picked up by the character Tim, this young Liverpudlian man who's a bit saucy to him in the pub and interests him with a bit of a trick. So Julian Clary's character Michael brings him back, and we get an early part in his kitchen as he cooks a meal and then sees how the night plays out. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Thanks, Tim. Yes, this piece was written by Stephen Clarke, who died last year, but he wrote it with Julian Clary in mind. And actually, there's a few things that came to me when I saw it. First of all, I enjoyed it, and I think many of the critics have been quite unkind about this piece. But actually, you can enjoy this on a number of levels, because essentially it opens with Julian Clary playing this architect, we're led to believe, who's preparing a dinner for a gentleman caller who will be arriving shortly. And while he's preparing dinner, he talks to the audience about all the different ways about death that can be imagined. And as you're listening to it, you feel like actually it's a monologue Julian Clary might have done on one of his shows. And that's when it becomes quite clear that Stephen Clarke really had Julian Clary in mind, obviously, for this piece. But at the other point that you note is that you're in this kitchen and, you know, everything's in stainless steel. Food is being prepped and portioned into little bowls or packets. Anything that he spills, he quickly gets out some sort of cleaning fluid and wipes it up with paper towels. And based on how you imagine that Julian Clary would be cooking in a kitchen, you feel like he's playing himself. But actually, that becomes the first part of the piece. But the second part is when this gentleman caller, Tim, arrives, who's played by James Nelson Joyce. And there suddenly becomes this whole series of mind games where each is playing off against each other to try and actually pretend there's something that they're actually not. And there's a moment when it all comes crashing down and we all go home after that. Fortunately, it's only 90 minutes with no interval. But for me, actually, I think it's quite amusing when you actually think back and look at what perhaps this piece is saying around, you know, life, how long you are here in this world, and what happens next. But also, I think when you think about Julian Clary himself, who's had quite a long time in show business, how he's now entering into his, he'll shortly be 60, if he's in his late 50s, you know, how he's entering into, you know, the autumn years of his life. And here's this young upstart played by James Nelson Joyce, who's, you know, challenging that all the time. And, you know, thinking about it, I think that's probably as simple as it is about looking, as musings about life and death, just with a whole lot of mind games and a little bit of full frontal nudity along the way, just to keep everyone entertained. Is it a brilliant play? Perhaps not. But actually, I did find both actors really engaging. Clary can even make something sound hilarious just by reading out the most mundane ingredients in a recipe. He does have a great sense of comic timing. You know that this man, you know, is funny from his past television shows and theatre. But actually here, he also plays a character that, you know, while it might be like himself, there's also quite a lot of vulnerability. I know some people had pointed out that he looks nervous in this piece, but actually, I think that works. Even if he's nervous for real, it's actually quite fascinating to watch him, because you've got the Julian Clary you know with this suit of armour full of comic barbs and shock tactics. And then at times you actually see him trembling and quivering, and actually I think that's quite nice. Obviously, too, being in the downstairs space of the Trafalgar Studios, there is no escape for both the audience and the performers, because everyone can be seen, and that is a fascinating thing in itself. People might have been used to seeing Julian Clary in a pantomime or on television, where there's that distance in larger theatres. Here you don't have any of that. And actually, it can be quite confronting, both for what they're talking about at times, but also how they're reacting to the piece as well. And it's interesting, the choices that they've made here in this production, to actually keep the actors, you know, right in front of the audiences. So, you know, all told, it may not say a lot about life and death that we haven't already known. And, you know, it might also be a little bit predictable. But actually, I thought it's definitely is a fascinating piece, and it's great to see Julian Clary on the stage and doing something interesting. Alice, what did you think?
Well, I share some of your feelings about it. I did wonder whether the writer Stephen Clarke had perhaps only left fragments and that these were put together. The piece is directed by Clarke's long-term collaborator, director Christopher Renshaw, who I think does a good job on it. It is a red herring of a play, in a way. A lot of musings. And in the end, one comes out thinking, well, where did that all lead? And there's an awful lot of words. You have to admire the actors for having learned that script, because it doesn't always follow, let's say, a storyline. It tends just to jump from subject to subject. And there's an awful lot of words in it. It's a very verbose play. Obviously, for many people, the star attraction will be Julian Clary and his camp persona. I was actually rather intrigued by him, because he actually possesses a lot of stage presence. And of course, his voice is very mellifluous. And I did begin to wonder what would happen if he was cast in something against type. I actually thought he was a jolly good actor, although he was well matched, I have to say, by James Nelson Joyce, who also acquitted himself very well. I wasn't overwhelmed by the play. The first part seemed to go on for an awful long time. I think it went on for about 20 minutes. It was in verse, while Julian Clary chopped and, you know, prepared his meal, and you got the aroma. And I think once he did break the fourth wall and spoke to a member of the audience, although I don't think that was followed up afterwards, it seemed to veer from point to point to point. And there was at one stage a moment when I thought, oh, I wonder whether this is somebody just put the actors and the writer into a rehearsal room and they just got together and this was a bit of an exercise. It did feel like that, how to get from one point to the other. It's okay, you know, you had a very, as you've said, a very nice set designed by Justin Nardella with a reference to a famous artwork in it as well. I was a bit relieved when James Nelson Joyce finally arrived. It's what you call the gentleman corner, Tennessee Williams style, and the bell rang, because the first monologue did seem to go on for quite a long time. I wasn't sure whether even Julian Clary was meant to be an architect, or whether the whole thing was role-playing. I mean, there were numerous backstories that came up, and it just felt as if both the characters were choosing between possible stories and laying out a possible background and then switching to another possible background. So this was, in a way, the problem for me, that I really didn't believe in any of the stories. But having said that, should I say I enjoyed it? I don't know. It passed the time. And I would be interested to see Julian Clary in another type of drama. And I think James Nelson Joyce, we should mention, was a good foil, and also obviously I had a grasp of the script, which is more than I had at times. It did seem to be about lying and storytelling and sex and death and murder, you know, a rumination in many ways. There was a bit of action near the end when things seemed to go into more jeopardy. And as you say, there was some full frontal nudity, which suddenly emerged Frankenstein-like, although far more attractive and buff than that. The technical side of it was very well done. You had Jamie Platt's lighting and Ed Lewis's rather filmic soundscape. My feeling by the end, It was okay. They all acquitted themselves well. It might be fun to share a bottle of wine and some pasta beforehand and then go into the show and be regaled by Julian Clary, Michael, cooking the same pasta meal and quaffing wine as well. So, you know, Le Grand Mort may still be a recipe for success. But I have to say, I think my tagline was, as a potential crime mystery, it was more truth than sleuth. And it did seem to be playing on this same kind of two-hander battle of wits, which didn't quite gel for me in the end.
Yeah, I more or less agree that it didn't quite work as a play. I found it very interesting. But the most interesting thing of all is Julian Clary. Like you, I felt that it didn't quite work in this play, but he is a very compelling performer and a very interesting performer. And it was good to see him play something slightly out of his comfort zone, slightly not his own comic persona. He certainly would be an interesting actor if you saw him in something else, but it would have to be a fairly narrow thing that you saw him in. You can't just say, well, he'll be doing Macbeth next week. It would have to be something that suited him. I think he would be an interesting presence in a play, but it would have to be something that really suited him. I don't think that he can go too far out of his comfort zone for this. And I think this was still within his comfort zone. I think the thing about this, though, is that it probably needed a little bit of work, and they didn't really have anyone around to work on it. I think that it's possible that, you know, had they come back to this play or looked at it, and if Stephen Clarke had still been around, you know, and they'd revisited the play, they might have wanted to make a few changes, or maybe he would have written something a bit stronger. Because certainly I think that there's some interesting ideas in here and some interesting playfulness in here. I wasn't quite so bored as with the verse speaking at first as some people have been, but yeah, it doesn't really match up to the rest of the play. And it would be nice to have a better feel of what exactly the play is about, because after all, we do flash back to the bar where they first meet, and we're not entirely sure whether they're play acting that or whether it's sort of genuinely meant to be a flashback. I think it is genuinely meant to be a flashback. It kind of works. It fills the time, and I think that the benefit is to see Julian Clary, especially if you, like me, have seen him since the mid-80s. It's interesting to see where he's come and where he will perhaps go later, and makes you think whether or not he can find something broader and more interesting acting parts later on. We're now going to talk about The Blinding Light at the German Street Theatre. This is a new play by Howard Brenton, in fact a world premiere. Howard Brenton has been doing some rather interesting plays recently, and this one, directed by Tom Littler, the artistic director of the German Street Theatre, this play stars Jasper Britton, Gayla Gordon, Susan Harker and Laura Morgan, and concerns a sort of missing period of August Strindberg's life. It's sometimes referred to as his Inferno period. He basically vanished for 4 years, and people thought he'd gone mad. And when he reappeared, his plays became much stranger and much more, to a certain extent, interesting. It happened around about the time when he divorced his second wife, and according to this play, he holds himself up in a Parisian hotel room and tries to become an alchemist and tries to make gold by finding Philosopher's Stone. In this, he is sort of partially helped and partially hindered by the maid, who wants to come and clean the room and is constantly talking at him. And then into this world, eventually, come Susanna Harker as his first wife and as his second wife, and they try to talk some sense into him, try to get him to be a reasonable person instead of a complete madman. I found this play really rather entertaining. It's a lot of fun. They certainly have a lot of fun with it. In fact, I think they corpsed a couple of times on the night I went. They were slightly off. There's a very good staring scene where I think they both basically tried to make each other laugh. Jasper Britton is always a very interesting actor. I mean, he does seem to be working all the time, which is a good thing. And he's very entertaining as Strindberg being completely over the top and mad. He's done this sort of thing before. I remember the first time I really encountered him 14 or 15 years ago when he did a double bill of The Taming of the Shrew and The Tamer Tamed, which is the Elizabethan answer play to The Taming of the Shrew. And he was extremely funny in that. And there were lots of things to remind me of that performance in this, especially because in The Tamer Tamed, he gets blown up and all sorts of nasty things happen to him. He goes very mad and gets very dirty, which is, of course, what happens in this play. We are dealing with an apparent madman who gets into this rather strange work of trying to make gold. There's a lot of really able support here, particularly by Lola, his maid, played by Laura Morgan, and we also have his first wife, Siri, the slightly aristocratic one, played by Susanna Harker, and then Gala Gordon as Frida, who is possibly the person who's stoked his madness by running off with another artist. And I thought it was a fascinating piece. One of the problems is that we perhaps don't know the real history, certainly in terms of the plays he wrote, or at least I didn't, so I wasn't really aware of exactly where we were in his life. And also, I mean, I've seen some of his major plays like The Dance of Death and Miss Julie, but I'm not entirely sure where this Inferno period matches between those two plays. So it is a bit problematic from that standpoint, not quite knowing where we are and where exactly this play is. I think we are slightly after Miss Julie, but before The Dance of Death, because the play is set in February 1896. So we are sort of between Miss Julie, which I think he wrote about 14 years earlier, and The Dance of Death, which he wrote in the 20th century. So we get elements of his relationship. Siri, his first wife, actually, I think, was the original Miss Julie, or at least was the basis for the original Miss Julie, because she was a rather posh young lady. I think that there's lovely performances from everybody, and it's a really nice chamber piece. I mean, the pity always is with the German Street Theatre is that they do very good stuff, but it's a tiny place. I mean, it feels even smaller than the Finborough. So although it gets very good reviews, plays don't really seem to break out from there, and it would be nicer to think that more people could get to see this. What did you think about this, Alice?
Yes, I think this was quite a coup to get a Howard Brenton world premiere for the start of Tom Littler as artistic director at the German Street Theatre. I had mixed feelings about this. I thought that The Blinding Light, it actually starts very well and it ends very well. But there is a part in it in the middle where it becomes rather undramatic and verbose. This isn't due to either the direction or the acting, or for that matter, the design and the lighting and the sound, all of which are very, very good. It's an odd play. It's quite a niche area to dwell on what is for many. I'm not saying that it's for everybody, but for many, this is quite an obscure part of Strindberg's life. And Strindberg himself, one might think of as the other Scandinavian writer, the other Scandinavian playwright. He's not as well known generally as, say, Ibsen is. But very good performances by everybody. Jasper Britton as this fiery, choleric Strindberg who's in his long johns. And then dons an apron as well, because he's trying to turn, of course, base metals into gold. There's a certain amount of intellectual name dropping, which they just about get away with, because it's got this feeling that he's rather mad and a bit pretentious as well. I mean, it starts off with a kind of face-off between him and the cleaner, Lola. Sounds like a showgirl, actually, Laura Morgan. And then you get a cat which is possibly hallucinatory when the wives come in. It is almost a Faustian pageant. So you get the aristocrat, Siri, very imperiously played by Susanna Harker. And she was actually an actress and the mother of his two children, and kind of harangues him to come back to Earth. And then you get Frieda Yule, as you say, the Austrian, who herself was an Austrian writer. And she looks as if she could have stepped out of a Gustav Klimt portrait. It's a good production. It's detailed. It's measured. There's some odd times when you get a few phrases which sound really, really modern, and it's almost as if Brenton is actually playing around and being playful and bringing in some kind of time traveling references. I mean, there was one line I noticed when we hear from one wife about him making his excuses and leaving like some old style tabloid hack. And another time there's a reference to an Ingmar Bergman film, Wild Strawberries. Yeah, I enjoyed the performances. I did wonder whether it was more of a radio play, or even, actually, it'd be totally left field, whether it could be turned into an opera, when the rather static parts of the women coming in and telling him he's got to pull himself together, but in a much more literary way than I am saying it, when they all came in. I have to say that it was very, very funny in parts, even though I found it a little bit stodgy. And it is about a niche episode in what many would find a niche writer's, even though he's written so many classics, Strindberg, he's not so well known generally. But at 90 minutes, good performances, a good start for Tom Littler. There's quite an ingenious design by Cherry Truluck for Lucky Bert, where you get a gravy brown late 19th century furniture in front of some more abstract painted screens, which apparently are blow-ups of Strindberg's own paintings, because he was a painter as well, and very nicely costumed by Emily Stewart. And when you get these kind of hallucinatory episodes, there's impressive lighting from William Reynolds. I wasn't overwhelmed by it, but it was interesting if you want to be interested in it. You know, some people might think, oh, this mad writer, why are we dwelling on it? It's not the best play that I've seen by Howard Renton, but it's good enough. Let's put it like that. And I wasn't overwhelmed, but there was enough humour in it and enough self-deprecation to hold me.
We're now going to talk about The Revlon Girl at the Park Theatre in their smaller space. This is a play by Neil Anthony Docking and is based on a true story about a group of bereaved mothers who summon a representative from Revlon to come and sell them beauty products. This is about 8 months after the Aberfan disaster, where a waste heap, waste from the coal mine at Aberfan, collapsed onto a school in a massive landslide, and 116 children were killed. In the community, it was massively devastating, because I think it was sort of almost an entire generation of children were wiped out in the disaster. So it is something that is probably not in the front of everybody's mind now, but it's certainly something that a lot of people remember. So what we're dealing with here is people dealing with this disaster in a slightly odd way, in getting a young woman to come and talk to them about perfume and makeup. Alice, could you tell me more about this play and what you thought of it?
This was a play that actually a lot of reviewers have liked a lot, I should say. I was slightly less enamoured of it, although I think anything, especially in view of events which have been in the last few months, thinking about the Grenfell tragedy, anything which looks at avoidable, terrible tragedies with real loss of life is a worthwhile play. Aberfan happened in 1966, and last year was actually then 50 years afterward. In fact, these waste slag heaps were built, were piled up at the back of this coal mining village on a hill on top of streams and slid down. So there was both the water and the slag from the heaps. This was a bit of a left field take. It's said that it's based on a true story. I perhaps would be more inclined to say that it was inspired by a true story. You've got a cast of very good female actors. This has been also touring. My reservations are that it rather uneasily mixes real events with fictional scenarios, and the piece is shaped rather more like a screenplay than a straight stage play. So you've got the four mothers turning up, the woman who we are calling the Revlon girl, having been called in by some unseen organizer, and we immediately get to know their personalities. They're quite broadly drawn, and you have this person descending, Charlotte descending from London, who's slim and blonde, to talk to these bereaved mothers. There's quite a bit of broad comedy, but as the evening progresses, the veneer cracks, and you get some of the despair and some very good, very well written parts where the home truths, you know, they threaten even the solidarity of these women whose children have all shared the same terrible fate when they were suffocated or otherwise by this slag heap in the school because the slag heap descended on the classrooms. It's a difficult ask when you're dealing with real life events like this where it's still within the memory and people who were involved are still alive. And I think a play like this needs care to strike the correct balance between what really happened and the imaginings of the playwright. And I'm not sure whether that totally worked in this. Whether it would work better as a screenplay, of course, is another thing. It was simply done at the Park Theatre, quite a simple backdrop. It just shifts. I felt like there was very uneasy shifts of tone. At times it was almost sitcom-like. And at other times it did go into what were, as I said, the better written parts, where you have the wisecracking one, Rona, suddenly launch into a speech about what is wrong with the tribunal and analysing, because there was a tribunal that was held after the disaster, when, you know, in many ways it's the usual thing that we get used to now and which we shouldn't be used to, you know, the kind of lessons will be learned scenario. And she dissects this quite searingly. And I think everybody in the audience was very moved by this, and it felt like an authentic voice. However, I have to say the whole scenario, as I've said, did beg some questions. By the end of it, I was wondering whether this Revlon girl or Revlon woman actually did come, or whether these were just events that were organized because these women met every week at a local hotel afterwards, and various events were organized. It even crossed the mind of somebody who was with me that why was it a Revlon girl? Why wasn't it an Avon girl? This may seem like nitpicking, but there was nothing in the program about the actual event or who was the Revlon girl or whether it really happened. And there was a bit of a Made in Dagenham feel to it, because this is, of course, set in the 1960s. And I should say that it was very, very nicely styled production. Costumes from Beryl Thomas and even the glasses from selectspecs.com. That got a mention in the programme. And also the wigs by Claire Pritchard-Jones. And they all looked totally, you know, it was spot on in terms of the way they looked. But it did feel as if the writer might have taken, Neil Anthony Docking, might have taken the Aberfan story and shoehorned it a bit into a more stereotypical story of a makeup representative coming and going through a catharsis with her. It almost felt like American made-for-television movie territory at times. Having said that, as I say, there were some points where authentic voices did break through, and I felt as if we were in another play then. I have to say that there were people around me who were much more affected by the play than me, and there were a few tears, and obviously felt more engrossed in the story than I did. I was just left wondering, and I feel as if a play which says that it's based on a true event, just like, you know, it's not the same by any means. Maid in Dagenham was based on a true event. We know about the real women who were involved. We didn't actually get that here. This may have been something that was done marking the 50 years since the Aberfan tragedy. All the actors were very good. There was a peaceable person who was a peacemaker, Sean, played by Charlotte Gray. Then you had the upwardly mobile Jean. So there were class divisions between the women, and that was played by Zoe Harrison. And the more superstitious Marilyn, played by Michelle McTernan, and Rona, played by Bethan Thomas, with the Revlon girl, played by, who was British, even though Revlon, of course, is an American firm, played by Antonia Kinley. It's a super cast, actually. They were very, very good. I just had a problem with the play as a whole. I felt it was uneven, that there were these shifts in tone. A few Americanisms came in sometimes, which I wasn't sure about whether that would be there, even with the influence of cinema in the 1960s. A bit of an odd ending as well, which made me wonder whether this was far more of a screenplay than a stage play, because I don't know whether it really came across. It's okay. I think any play that talks about these tragedies and questions what really is learned from them, and which we can draw, sadly, and time again, parallels, it is worthwhile, especially in stimulating people to think about these things in the wider political sense, as well as the personal and terrible individual tragedies. The direction by Maxine Evans is fine. It just felt a bit uneven, and it felt as if the Aberfan tragedy had been shoehorned into a movie trope, which didn't sit too easily with me. I mean, having said that, as I said, a lot of the reviews really, really loved it, and it obviously struck a chord with some. I just felt that it was a bit of an opportunity missed, and I would have liked to have something a bit less stereotypical in it at some points. Another odd thing that I found was that we weren't really told sometimes where these women were within the society of Aberfan. That's to say, I read afterwards that the upwardly mobile character, Jean, that she's actually, when she talks about her husband, that her husband is the local vicar. That didn't come across to me at all. I thought perhaps he was an executive within the coal board, because of course this is also the time, even though the coal industry was in decline, that it was still part of the nationalised coal industry, which is another reason why it had such reverberations. I mean, this did become a global tragedy. This wasn't just big news in Britain. This was big news all around the world, which is why perhaps the playwright decided to bring in a representative from an American-based firm, which should have had more of a resonance for me than it did in the end. As I said, a lot of people have really, really liked this and have been very, very moved by this. And in view of recent events, it did strike a chord with me, but I did feel that perhaps it could have been something a lot more.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.